Hey, everyone, and welcome back to The Perspective. I'm your host, Ethan, and alongside me tonight is Rationality Rules, a.k.a. Steve Woodford. Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. And how about yourself, Ethan?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited to have you on, man.
Well, thank you for having me, genuinely.
I know it's, what is it, 1 or 2 in the morning by you?
Yes, but I've, true to form, being a YouTuber, I live up to basically the American time that I should be going to sleep. Oh, and then when I visited Texas, I started going to sleep at the equivalent of about 6 a.m. for the UK. So it's good. I'm awake. I've got coffee as well.
Anyways, for those watching, this is a show where we tackle paranormal and supernatural claims, belief in aliens, conspiracy theories, and pretty much any claim you want to bring us. The number is at the bottom of the screen, 951-364-2430. You ready to jump into calls, Steve?
Absolutely. Let's do this.
Okay. So our first caller is from North Carolina and wants to talk about the idea of Christian agnosticism. James, you're on with Steve and Ethan. How are you?
Hey, guys. Doing pretty good. How's everyone doing this fine evening?
I am
very well, thanks.
So what do you got for us?
First off, Steven, huge fan, brother.
Hey,
oh,
pleasure.
Sorry, go ahead and gush. I was gushing too.
No, yeah, thank you very much.
All gush, I'll have to remember the delay. But Steven, huge fan. Keep it up. I've been following your channel for quite some time. So hopefully I won't be the one of, I'll be one of many people who gush over you tonight. So thank you so much.
And you are a Christian, aren't you?
I am a Christian, yes.
Nice. All right, cool. So what would you like to chat about?
Yeah, so let's kind of dive into this idea of Christian agnosticism. And there's a few ways we can probably look at this, and I'd love to hear, you know, some of your guys' input on this. So really quick, Christian, because of the ideas associated with Christianity, like I would say we're still feeling the ripples of that effect, right? In more ways than one. And then agnosticism, because it's very hard to actually know. I would probably say one of the biggest tenets in Christianity, which is Jesus died on the cross and resurrected, right? So there's enough evidence or lack of evidence that makes it a little problematic. So I guess on that, what are your guys' thoughts? And we'll kind of open it up from there.
Would you like to start?
Okay, so with Christ's resurrection, the first thing I think of when it comes to Christ's resurrection is a point that was expressed by Hitchens. It's been expressed by many. And that is that even if Christ did resurrect, it doesn't, by virtue of that, show that any of his other claims were true. And this goes towards, you know, the level of credence that we can have towards a proposition such as Christianity. It won't be just that you can grant one of the major parts and all of the rest will bleed out. So I guess my first take on it is that I think I need to know more specifically. Yeah, actually, I need more on the table, if that's all right. Tell me what you're wanting, unless, Ethan, you want to jump in.
No, please.
Yeah, so what I would kind of like dive in on is the agnostic part of it is so here's where everybody cheers, right? It is next to impossible to prove the idea that Christ rose from the dead. Okay, it is next to impossible. And even then, the accounts are, well, there are some issues with the accounts. So from the propositional perspective, of that right there alone, we have problems. Now we can expand that out to the meta story and I would say the Bible as a whole, and there's a Christian idea there. I think it revolves around grace. It revolves around probably the idea that the victim has some kind of say, right? And we see that in a direct response to Rome as well. So I don't know if I would agree that the individual propositional claims, if you undermine that, you know, it goes away, because we've been doing that for now 2,000 years and it hasn't gone away. So I don't know if that more on the table? What else do you need and where do you want to open this up to?
Well, one point I could raise in reference to what you were saying there is, you know, it's the idea that Christianity has preserved itself over 2,000 years. Is that the position you were expressing or endorse or not?
Christianity has definitely preserved itself or perpetuated its existence for a good period of time. And maybe even the symbology associated with Christianity is reaching its end. But I don't see that happening any time super soon. So I'll hold to the idea that Christianity is around.
Okay, so the Christianity that we have today is very, very unlike the Christianity we had 200 years ago. And the Christianity that we had 200 years ago is very, very unlike what we had 1,000 years ago. I made a video, you may have seen it, since you said that you watch my content, titled The Most Successful Myth of Religion. And it was related to this idea that Christianity and religions in general have been preserved in their current state. And, you know, there must be something to this because, you know, they've had this form of preservation. But it's just not true. There's been massive changes in, say, slavery. You know, the Bible explicitly endorses slavery. Slavery was just fine for a very long time. It was part of the transatlantic slave trade. And yet now Christians think slavery is just wrong and they have to reinterpret all of these verses. You have the homophobia in the Bible as well. That's slowly but surely making its way out. And what I mean by that is we're having, if I want to be derogatory, more of a cafeteria Christianity, where someone will approach these topics and go, well, I have my morality and I have to somehow ascertain that from this book and then claim that I get it from this book. So I would definitely put pushback on the idea that Christianity has been preserved for 2,000 years. I don't think that's true. You could argue that the central motif has been preserved. But as has been seen in the sociological literature, Christianity does a good job of showing sacrificial motif, but that motif has existed in many different forms. And that's, you could almost argue, part of our psyche. That isn't going anywhere, and it will manifest itself in our religions, in our narratives, in our ideologies, in the stories we tell ourselves forever. If not in name of Christianity, then at least in name of something.
I have a question for you before. You are an agnostic Christian, correct?
I don't quite know yet, actually.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Know thyself. So it's something that I'm wrestling with.
What to you is the most compelling evidence for the Christian God?
Well, that's an interesting question. And where I would kind of go with Christian God is, evidence probably not. It depends on your epistemological standard or how you attribute your experience to those things. Now, how do I attribute it? I would say I probably had a idea associated, you know, with touching the divine or something like that, like a divine madness of sorts from Phaedrus.
I'm sorry, a divine. Say that one more time.
That exists. A divine madness. It's from Phaedrus. It's one of the Socratic dialogues.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that.
Where he talks about love.
Okay.
Yeah, and passion. So, and one of the things is, I would say I don't think science could prove a God exists. Especially because we've kind of effectively put God outside of space and time, right? You know, or or something like that. We can't use God of the gaps because that's a really dangerous road to go down. So overall, evidence for the Christian God depends entirely on someone's epistemological standards. And as far as mine is concerned,
I do have a question. Sorry to interrupt, James. I do have a question that relates to that. I'd be very intrigued to hear what you think, if it's okay, Ethan.
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing. If you could, James, talk a little bit closer into the mic because you seem to be cutting out occasionally.
Awesome. Okay, so you were saying about how God is defined in such a way as to be outside of the universe, which makes him infallible, right? There's no way to, you know, disprove this. Well, before we talk about a way that potentially that can happen, this is similar to reincarnation. Reincarnation is very difficult to debunk, to, you know, have objections to, undercutting or rebutting defeaters, because it situates itself in such a way as to make it not accessible. But with God, we have an interesting thing that's been plaguing us, well, before Christianity was even invented or discovered or occurred, depending on your take, and that is the problem of evil, which comes up again and again and again. Because if we say that God is all-powerful and we say that God is all-loving, then how do you personally explain the enormous amount of suffering that we see in the world that's not due to free will? So millions and millions of years before we existed, if you accept evolution, because I just want to make this to your state of mind, millions of years before evolution, we have sentient beings dying in bushfires. Why? Why would a good, all-powerful, all-loving God have that? I was wondering whether or not you have an answer or a way that you would deal with that reductio.
Who says he's good?
Oh, I see. So you would say that he isn't all good.
I mean, I just said who says he's good, and then how do we? I guess the only way we would be able to do that is to challenge our assumptions and our morality against his, or something to that effect. Which I don't want to fall down the trap of we can't question his morality, because I don't think that jives either. Because we can question a God. Now I don't know if it's intrinsically good or intrinsically evil. I just there may be something there, but the problem of evil, I think, kind of relates maybe to the problem of suffering or pain in some regard. And again, I'm not as well versed in some of those arguments. I would just say I think that without some form of love or self-improvement, you would, let me rephrase that. In order to have self-improvement and even love, you have to have pain.
Do you want to take that one, Ethan?
No, I just, I'm curious a little bit more on your perspective on what God is, because it sounds like you're pretty on the fence with some things. So do you not know whether your God is good or not?
Well, I wouldn't say we know whether the God is good or not. I would just say it's in its own right. It can be a very terrifying perspective to think about, because, for example, a God who kills a child because the father made a promise to him that if I come back from this victory, I will sacrifice the first thing. And of course, this is very loose, right? That's a pretty terrifying prospect.
Right.
So what you say really does matter. And that's an important thing to consider.
Okay.
I will add to that, actually. Yeah, yeah. I will, if that's okay. So there's many references in the Bible to describing God as good. And the classical conception of God, at least with the Christians, is, well, actually with all Abrahamic religions, is that he is good. And the reason why the problem of evil is a problem for theism is because they want to maintain both of those attributes. there's various responses you can give. I entirely respect that you're not read on the literature. That's fair enough. There's many theodicies, is what that's what they're called. But I will just say that if you do drop one of those attributes, then the problem of evil will largely go away. So if you do say, who is to say that God is all good, and you drop that, then all of a sudden that reductio isn't going to work, because you could look at life and you can see children dying from leukemia and all of the, you know, nasty viruses and situations that we see, and you can just go, maybe there's an all-powerful God, maybe there's a God that's doing his best, but he's even not all God. You could say that there's an not omnipotent, so not all-powerful, but this God is all good, doing his best, and you can explain these situations away that way. Or you can say that he is all-powerful, but he's not all good, he doesn't care. It's just, either way, you're going to end up in a situation that's very uncomfortable, and especially in relation to how God is typically defined, both historically and contemporarily. So it sounds like your Christianity is quite a bit different to what you would meet in. I can understand why you're using the agnostic term here. So I just wanted to throw it on the table for you, so you can see that you can deal with the reductio by giving up on one of those horns.
I appreciate that, Stephen. I really do appreciate that. And one of the things I think I would maybe just kind of expand on is the idea. So I think good is, I don't want to get too crazy and get, you know, caught between good and evil and all that fun stuff. I would just say, I think that on the all good part, that's a matter of perspective in some regard. And I don't know if that's super useful sometimes. Now, omnipotent, that's actually an interesting way to look at it. And one of the things that I struggle with is, what's the relationship to his creation? And if God enters into a covenant with someone, that would be a limitation on his power. So he would no longer fit the definition of omnipotence within the contract. And we see him entering into contracts or covenants in some ways. And so I don't know, you know, maybe it's honoring your contract, in which case, is that good or bad? And now we have to maybe examine that further.
When you say he's entering into contracts, what do you mean by that?
So he enters into a covenant with Abraham, right? He enters into he says, you know, even at the end of the flood story, right? Here's your magical rainbow, and that's a sign of that, like, of what I did, I'll never do this again. So, hey, that's like a contract in some regards. That's saying, hey, I'm never going to do this again. And so I'm limiting my power fundamentally to deal with you. And he also, and you can see that come to its I won't say logical conclusion, but you can see some of that in Christ, right? So now he has limited his power in one way in order to sacrifice himself and that motif, and then therefore give us grace and advocate, all that fun stuff, which is also further limiting in contract, you know, covenant and contractual relationship with his creation.
Okay. So earlier you had said that you don't think God could be scientifically proven to exist. Is that correct?
Yes. I don't know where science could discover the supernatural, and that is something we've been wrestling with for quite some time. So
if you had to present a case to a skeptic panel, like Steve and myself right now, what do you think we would find most compelling, or what evidence would we find most compelling that we could discuss right now for the existence of, it doesn't have to be the Christian God, it could just be God in general.
Well, there's maybe a few I don't know about evidence, to be honest with you. And the reason why is because I don't know if under certain frameworks it's a convincing factor or something like that, where you know you can be convinced of the existence of a god. Now, there is probably something associated with connection to people you hang out with or you associate yourself with that might start to go down that line. But I don't know if I would submit any evidence other than to continue always improving ourselves and continuing asking the great questions in life.
Well, I genuinely appreciate your honesty and openness. It's definitely refreshing. We got to wrap up and get to our next caller in a moment.
If I could just Steve, quickly drop two quick responses, if that's all right. Yeah, it's very thoroughly enjoyable conversation. And likewise to what Ethan just said, thank you for your time. But I thought I'd offer you a quick response to the contract stuff. If I had the ability to punch at a certain power, right? And then I said to someone, hey, I'm going to go easy on you. This is a contract I'm entering into. I'm only going to tap you lightly. I still have the ability to hit hard. So rather what I'm doing is honoring a commitment, but I'd still have that power. I'm just limiting it according to a circumstance. Likewise, if God was to enter a contract with Moses or whoever it might be and say, hey, listen, you know that genocide I did with Noah? I'm not going to do that again. He still could. It's just the only reason he doesn't do it is to obey by the contract, but he still has the power to do it. And then the second point I wanted to potentially leave you with then is that the problem of animal suffering before we exist is a really seriously, I think it's a very powerful and potent example of the problem of evil, because if you have sentient creatures suffering in bushfires or just nature in general, natural selection is very, very brutal, long before humans have even evolved, then this idea of entering into a contract cannot make any sense, because there was no humans to make contracts with that could possibly provide a form of justification for this untold violence and horrific evil that we see in the world. But yeah, sorry to if I've taken things too far aside, but I did want to just give you a good response.
Keep going if you had more.
No, that's good. That's good. I just wanted to offer that up to James.
James, in a minute or less, did you have any closing remarks?
Oh, man, I hate you for limiting to a minute.
All right, 2 minutes.
Oh, that's fair. Hey, so Ethan, thank you so much for what you do, brother. You know, your friendly neighborhood atheist. Keep it up. Appreciate it. And then Stephen, rationality rules in more ways than one. However, I think it's a limited framework in some ways. So thank you so much for what you do, and I'll continue to follow your channel. It's been a privilege and honor to speak with you both. And I will take your nuggets and I will go forth with them. Thank you.
Best of luck on your journey, James. Like, genuinely best of luck. I hope you find the measure of peace I think you're looking for.
I hope I never do, actually.
What?
Wait. Why?
Because the destination is not what matters. It's the journey that matters.
Oh, wisdom being dropped. Look at that. Love it.
Awesome, James. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Cheers. Bye, guys.
All right. Have a good one. All right. That was your first call, Steve. What'd you think?
That was lovely. What a lovely phone call to get. James seemed just like an absolutely earnest, lovely individual. I genuinely wish him all the best. It was a good conversation. Like, again, thanks for having me on, by the way. Really enjoyable.
Hell yeah. So we're going to change pace a little bit. Our next caller saw an apparition of a child who disappeared from their pantry and believes it was a ghost. Kate from Illinois, you're on with Ethan and Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Ethan and Steve? Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for calling in today. It's good to hear from you. And thank you for waiting on hold.
No problem.
So what do you, what do you got for us?
Oh, sorry. Just jumping in. back in 2012, my husband and I and our two daughters moved in with my mother-in-law into his childhood home, the farm that he grew up on. We had a lot of work going on in the house, so we decided to move in with them. It was easier. About a month after we moved in, I was pulling into the driveway, and the house was situated as such where the headlights shine directly into where the kitchen table is, and directly across from that is a pantry. And I thought it was my kid, just a child kind of dart from the table into the pantry. They didn't really recognize the pajamas, but whatever, grandma probably had them. I come in the house and I could see the child peeking out like from behind the door a little bit of the pantry. I set my purse down on the table to the right, turned to the left, grabbed the door and went peekaboo, and there was no child there. And it just, like, there's no way to get out past me. And, you know, I'm kind of looking around like, how did this happen? And I immediately went into the bedroom that they were staying in. Both of them were sound asleep. Neither one of them were wearing the pajamas I had seen when I, you know, when I saw the child. The next day, the next evening, we were having a dinner with the family. My sister-in-law and my brother-in-law had come over. And my sister-in-law asked, you know, how's everything going? And I said, great, but, you know, did you ever get the feeling that this house was haunted? And she just, like, the color drained from her face. She went pretty cold, and she started telling me a couple stories. And as she was telling me, my brother-in-law walks up, and he's like, well, how did you know about that? I never told anybody about that. And she's like, no, this happened to me. And he's like, no, that happened to me. And so as the, you know, conversation went on, my husband joined in, my mother-in-law joined in. They ended up all sharing these stories that were really similar to each other, but they'd never told each other growing up. So it was really weird. Then somehow the subject got onto their dog, their family pet. His name was Scruffy, who had passed away a few months before we had moved in. He was like 15 or 16 years old. They tell this story about him. They all laugh, and then it kind of falls silent, as it tends to do. And just as it falls silent, we hear the basement door, the door to the basement steps, which is an exterior door, slam shut, the clip, 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 clip of dog paws going down the steps, and then you could hear the squeak of his little box springs of the bed that they had for him in the basement. Well, the problem with that was that door had been screwed shut since Scruffy died months before this. Completely screwed shut. They had work done on the house. My dog was asleep on the porch. We could see her right through the window. And like, there was really no way to explain that. And even my mother-in-law, she was like, that sounded just like Scruffy came in the house. And it was so crazy. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
So do these type of...
seeing the child and everything, I could have written off, but the dog thing was really strange.
Was the child apparition your first encounter with something like this, or have you had a lot of events like these taking place in your life?
Growing up, I had a lot of events taking place like that, and into my adult life. So it wasn't. It was just really strange to me. It didn't alarm me. It didn't scare me. I thought, wow, if that was a ghost, that's cool. If not, that's cool. You know, it really didn't. I was fairly used to any kind of activity or the possibility of activity by then. I just thought it was strange. They're like, it didn't seem like the type of family that would experience anything like that or have kept it from each other or even me. Them knowing that I was pretty open to all things paranormal and supernatural. So,
Steve, have you ever dealt with people who have seen apparitions before?
Privately, yes. And also, I can tell you that I've dealt with experiences like this from when I was younger. I used to I would now say it's hallucinations, but when I was younger, I know what I saw, and I would describe it as some people would say to me, "You didn't see it." And I'd be like, no, I did see it. And I realize now that that's not the right approach to these kind of topics. So this has been a very interesting story here, and I'm looking forward to diving in. I don't know if you want me to go first, Ethan, or...
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, sweet. So what's interesting... where to start? Okay, when I was young, I used to see similar kind of things. Some of them were obviously hallucinations. So maybe not. For instance, you know, in Lord of the Rings, you have that, I forget what they're called, but you have like a black cloak that's like floating off the ground and it comes towards the screen.
Confession, I've never seen Lord of the Rings before.
Blasphemy. Absolute blasphemy.
I can't sit through a 3-hour movie unless it's a Marvel movie. Those are just
dude.
I put on the first Lord of the Rings. I got through about 40 minutes and I'm like, this is so boring, and I turned it off.
Well, I am grotesquely offended. Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
What's going on? What's
I'm
this?
I'm sorry. It was totally up my alley. I loved movies like that when I was a kid, but no, I have the attention span of a kindergartner.
Same. It is so difficult for me to focus on things, especially like really long movies. Like I said, unless it's a Marvel movie, like the next Spider-Man is going to be 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and I can't wait. I'm super excited. I got tickets to see it on Thursday.
That's unless totally it's non-stop action throughout the entirety, you're not interested.
Yeah, I guess. No, if it has a good story, I'm down. But Lord of the Rings just seems like it was, what's that guy? It just seems like it's just walking for 9 hours straight. Like, that's all they're doing is walking.
Oh, goodness. Like, right, we're done with this. We're shelving this. We're getting back to the claim. I cannot.
We'll get back to the claim.
I'm triggered. Okay. So, all right. So I saw these hallucinations. Some of them, I would now say, are quite easy to identify as just very strong. And, like, they feel absolutely real as any experience that I've had that I would say I actually did have. But some of them were genuinely difficult to identify whether or not they were hallucinations. Now, there's a philosopher called Graham Oppy, someone that I've really enjoyed the work of. And the way that he looks at these kind of things, the way he looks at the world in general, if I'm not misrepresenting him, is that we basically want explanations for things that we see and things that we experience. And normally, we will pay what's known as an ontological price. We will pay a price in what we commit ourselves to in order to get those explanations. So, for instance, I've got a mug right here. If this mug I turned and it was gone, there's various ways that I can explain that. One way I can explain it is by saying I must have put it down some, you know, in a different position to what I remember. And in terms of commitments, that doesn't commit me to much. It just commits me to humans can make mistakes. And I know that's true, so it's not a cost, really. Or I could say a ghost moved it. That's very, very expensive, because all of a sudden I have to commit myself to the idea that things which have like my consciousness or a consciousness like me can exist without a body, that they can exist in a realm that's not physical, and that they can interact with a physical world despite not being physical themselves, if you see what I mean. There's a lot of like things I've got to buy into in order to have that as an explanation, whereas I could just say I must have made a mistake. The same is true of hallucinations. I can say, look, we know that we hallucinate, and we also know that we can have group hallucinations, and people can have very similar hallucinations, and that people, when they speak about it, will have their memories change. Our memories change as we go over it. It doesn't stay the same. There's plenty of studies on this. Committing yourself to that explanation of things doesn't cost you anything. You don't need to commit yourself to any of these extra things that we don't use as explanations elsewhere, or we're going to pay that higher price. So there's the first response I would have, is that it's quite costly. So I guess I could phrase this as a question for you. When we damage our brain, we know that it corresponds with our personality changing, right? So if you damage the prefrontal cortex, it makes it so that we've got this down to a T. We know precisely how that affects an individual. If you damage this part, it does this. You damage this part, it does this. But in order to have a ghost, or in order to have something that exists after its death, such as the dog or whatever it might be, we need to believe that when we die, all of this and this dies, the consciousness somehow is fine. For what reason do you think that's true? And I assume that you would have to think that that is true to attribute these things to these individuals, to these ghosts. What makes you think that's likely?
Well, when it comes to the child, I'm not sure that that was an actual ghost as in a trapped soul or consciousness that's, you know, stuck somewhere in this dimension. I believe it was perhaps or could have been more like a residual type situation where bringing young children back into the home and bringing a pet back into the home may have kind of brought a little bit of solidness, you know, made some imprinted emotional energy kind of visible to me. I only say that because we noted the pajamas, and the pajamas was the strange thing. As I described them to my mother-in-law, she recognized them, which back in the 80s, every little boy had, you know, Thundercats pajamas with the red t-shirt or the blue t-shirt and the red sweatpants. So, and that's what I saw. So I had never seen those in the house. There's no pictures, you know, of my husband wearing them, but, you know, one could assume that I would just assume he had those considering we were the same age. When it comes to the dog, again, I don't know if that was so much a trapped spirit of Scruffy or a kind of like a manifestation of collective consciousness focusing on that animal. It was the first time all three of them had been in the house since he passed away. They all love that dog very much. You know, he was there for a big part of their lives. So having them all remember or having the same memories and laughing may have kind of, again, sparked that energy residual having been left over from when he was alive. I'm a big believer in, you know, emotional energy and trauma imprints on the fabric of this time. And certain circumstances, whether it be, you know, the moon is here and, you know, someone flushed a toilet in Japan and whatever it is, no one really knows the algorithm of what would cause these things to become visible. But I am a big believer in there's a difference between spirits and ghosts, and not everything paranormal that people experience is an actual example of consciousness of a previously living being. I do believe in the power of imprinted emotional energy.
So
I think that's more what it was.
Did I hear you correctly in saying you believe that bringing children and pets into the home gave you some type of imprint or changed something for you?
I believe it stirred up what was, you know, what was already there. Just a lot went on in that house. A lot of stuff went down in that house when they were kids that was traumatic to them. I mean, they had a good childhood and everything, but there was some trauma there at home. So, like I said, I believe high emotional situations do kind of leave an imprint or a little residual energy behind. And with bringing kids back into, young kids back into the house and a dog back into the house after having been empty for a while of those things, could have possibly kind of stirred up a little bit of residual energy is what I believe it was.
So why, like for me, when I see things or, I write them, typically write them off as, hey, I saw something. I don't know what I saw, but I won't jump to it being a ghost. I'll just say, I don't know. Why not stay on that and say like, hey, I saw something. I don't know what it is. What's bringing you from that? I don't know what it is to this is a ghost or a soul or another some type of consciousness.
I believe it was because it was a child, and I was fairly new mom. My oldest was six, so I'm fairly new mom. And it was the fact that it was a child and it was not either one of mine. It had to be something else. And it was I know memories change as we remember, but this has not changed since I saw it. It caught me off guard. I was not expecting it at all. But I do believe, I went in more of the spiritual ghost connection only because I have no other way to explain why I would have seen a child when it clearly wasn't either one of mine. and the resemblance, perhaps, you know, the fact that I just thought it was one of my kids, it was the right size, the right hair color. I think maybe that's why I focused on it a little bit more. Normally I would have been like, yeah, whatever, you know, maybe I was tired or sleepwalking or maybe, you know, but, and I really, it stuck in the back of my brain. I didn't focus on it like the whole next day or anything, but she just happened to ask me how things were going. And, you know, that it was strange. It was very strange. And I have to believe it was because I saw a child.
Can I ask if you are a Christian, if you're a theist, if you believe in God?
I'm not a Christian. I'm a Satanist.
Okay.
Ooh.
But I believe in a creator.
Okay, so do you want to go?
Oh, sorry. No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just, so you're not the Church of Satan Satanist, where they don't believe in a God. You do believe in a God.
I believe in the possibility. I believe in the possibility of a God. The Church of Satan, yeah, they're more lean towards the atheist side. I'm part of the Satanic Temple, which we're allowed to believe whatever we want to believe. If we want to believe in God, that's great. If not, that's great. But the church doesn't, the temple doesn't, you know, offer okay. any education to
I
believe in either way.
The it's, Satanic Temple was atheist in nature.
Satanic, but not. They don't believe in a literal Satan.
Correct.
And the temple itself does not, you know, propagate belief in any deity or anything like that. But we're allowed to believe whatever we want.
Okay. So the reason I bring this up is that there's something known as God of the Gaps. You may or may not be aware of it, but basically, what's happened throughout history is we've said, we don't know, therefore God, right? So before Charles Darwin, before we understood about evolution by natural selection, you had William Paley and theists in general in the States and in the Middle East. You still have this happening where they will say, we don't know how we got the complexity of what we are. No way to explain it other than we are God's creation. And what you said was that you didn't know how to explain this. Therefore, this is the best explanation to go for. And as in the concentrated energy from multiple people in the house that love the dog. I'm not sure that I see how that's not an argument from ignorance, which is we don't know, therefore God, I guess in this case, to throw in a horrible pun, we don't know, therefore dog. But if we consider this, right? So you've got two...
I'm sorry, that tickled.
I'm glad you liked it. So consider this then. You've got two supernatural explanations on the table. So, I mean, you've got other natural ones. One could be that it was a hallucination. Another one could be that there was a rat in the mattress that was bouncing up and down. Another one could be that, you know, there was structural damage that was caused that isn't visible, but it caused it to shake or whatnot. But the two supernatural ones you've put on the table is that dogs have spirits and can interact with physical objects. So there's a lot, as I was saying, about in cost to be able to commit yourself in order to get that explanation. Or you have that dogs have spirits and can interact with physical objects. Plus you have this emotional energy that manifests the dog to be able to do it on the mattress. Because both of those are the same, except for the latter has an extra thing on top, which is emotional energy. It seems that if you're going to take one of those propositions, you're surely going to have to be better off going for the first one because it commits you to less commitments and gets you the same explanation. In philosophy, they would call this Occam's razor. You should take the one that makes fewer assumptions if you get the same explanatory value.
Okay.
So do you see like how that would make it so that your better option here would be to just say that the dog has a spirit and he came in and jumped on the mattress, as opposed to saying that the God has a spirit, he jumped on the mattress because additionally there was emotional energy? Like the scenarios are the same, except one of them has extra baggage that doesn't do anything to make the explanation easier or better in any way.
Well, in the way that I framed it and what I believe, I do believe that, you know, animal who, I do believe dogs have spirits, but that's not what I believe happened in this situation.
May I interject for a moment? If I could interject for one moment. Do you believe all animals have spirits? Is it just dogs and cats, or where are you at on this? Like, do snakes and tarantulas, do they have them too?
Slugs?
Possibly. I don't put much thought into that part of it. I believe this because of the attachment, the emotional attachment to dogs and pets that we love. And other experiences growing up and stuff like that, but I would have to analyze those from all sides, and I just never did. I leaned more towards the supernatural because we could not understand how or why we would have heard that door slam, and the noise of going down the stairs. We just can't explain how we all could have heard that, except for a group hallucination. Which, is that possible? Sure. Hallucination could be the same word for manifestation of activity, depending on what you believe or choose not to believe. If they would have said, no, we've never had any activity in this house ever, I don't know what you're talking about, I probably would have just written it off as I was tired, maybe I inhaled too many paint fumes from working on the house, whatever. I would have completely ended it right there. Mm-hmm. I was led down that kind of idea of it only because they said yes. And maybe if they would have said yes and his sister would have given me one example, I probably still would have been like, nah, that's not enough, for me to say this was a manifestation of anything. So the idea that, I had no idea they even believed in any of this stuff at the time. So that kind of shook me a little bit just to hear him, even his mom, talk about things that I had no idea they believed in or the possibility of. So as the conversation just kept going and their experiences were so similar, yet they'd never spoken about it to each other, I thought that was interesting, but again, never dove into it. Had they said, no, we never experienced anything, you're crazy, whatever, I would have said, okay, I'm crazy, and would have just, or I'm overtired, whatever, and would have just dropped it right there. But it just seems like every time I tried to debunk it, something else from, the paranormal side or the spiritual side came in. So that's kind of why we left it like that. You're absolutely right. Something could have moved in the basement and made those, just a matter of timing, made those coils squeak that way. But we can't explain why we all heard that door slam.
Did you say that you've got many other reasons to believe in this supernatural sphere, this astro, realm, whatever it might be? It's not just these two stories. Is it true that you have many reasons to believe in this?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So one thing I could say here is that if you find that you've bought into the supernatural, you think it's real and that it's totally a way to explain things, and then you come across a story like this or an event like this, then you have that as part of your epistemic toolkit, which means that you can just say, oh, okay, I can explain that in terms of this. And you're not actually paying much of a price because you have already committed yourself to a supernatural world. Whereas for a skeptic like myself, a naturalist, someone that's I don't need those explanations, even for someone who's hallucinated himself, I presume you can see why I would be so hesitant to buy such a costly explanation when there are good explanations. Also, I just don't know. I can't figure out the answer, which would be more palatable to someone like myself. I can sympathize why you would, if you already believe in the supernatural, why you would want to go towards that answer.
Real quick, I want to read a super chat from Philip Leach. It's important to admit when we're wrong. It's more important to dissect why we're wrong so that we don't make new beliefs based on some unsound reasoning. Let rationality rule. I like that.
Yeah, I got you.
Kate, are you, it sounds like you might be, it sounds like you're saying you need an explanation for this, since you don't have another explanation that this is. Why not, to jump back to earlier, why not just say, I don't know?
I don't know. You know, this is what I believe, but I don't know.
Okay.
There's no way to know. No, this is what I believe. And I haven't, I have accepted the supernatural and the paranormal, but it's not in the forefront of my daily life. And I'm the kind of person who will absolutely go through everything I can think of environmentally, you know, scientifically, situationally, that could explain these things. And like I said, until I would, there was the child being the child, there was no way for me to explain it to myself. His sister is a person I trust. So if she would have said, no, I've never experienced anything in this home whatsoever, I would have put it, completely marked it down as, yes, a hallucination. I must have been, like I said, overtired or distracted or, you know, and had perhaps the situation with the dog activity not happened, I might have even still would have gone back to the original sighting was, you know, something that was in my own mind.
Did you say that you don't apply this to many areas of your life? So you'll go for supernatural explanations sometimes, but not all the time.
If I experience something unexplainable and I cannot even spin a logical reason to explain it, then yes, I start to wonder about, okay, what if it was something supernatural or esoteric or, you know, something else that maybe I don't even know exists. The belief of this such a thing exists, you know, maybe
what do you,
like that, but I don't.
Got you. So what do you think to this worry then?
Go ahead.
Appealing to the supernatural, apologies for interrupting you. I got the point that I wanted to run with. And that is that if you're going, the problem with having the supernatural to be able to explain things is that you can use it. It's like a tool that can just be used everywhere. I don't know what tool we should, you know, metaphorically give it, but it just applies to basically anything. So, for instance, I've turned up at my office, my cup's not in the right place. Well, I could just appeal to the supernatural if I don't want to think about or don't know a natural explanation. My things, some of the bits that I need to be able to record's not here. It's at my house. I could easily just explain that in terms. I could try and explain that in terms of, you know, nature and physical things, but I could just go, probably, you know, some spiritual force, a dynamic force moved it. It works as an explanation. And if I was to find that in my life, for all of the easy things, I'm just appealing to nature, I'm appealing to the physical, I'm going, yep, these are the explanations. But whenever things get really difficult and I'm forced into a position where I have to go, I don't really know. And then it's then when I start bringing out the supernatural as an explanation. For me personally, that would tell me that I'm just very uncomfortable with not knowing, and I need to clog it with, I need to know, like it's just an important thing. And that's when I'm appealing to the supernatural. Because if you appeal to the supernatural only for difficult things and not for easy things, I would think that it suggests that you're using it as a gap filler. What do you think to that?
I don't, I understand what you're saying. And it is easy. It could be easy to do that sort of thing. But when you are a full believer in an experience or in these kinds of things, and for the most part alone in that world, you tend to want the supernatural to be the last explanation. Because then it could send one into a, you know, a spiral of why, you know, an existential crisis that will never be able to answer. So, and for me personally, I use the theory of five whys to keep myself from spitting out that way. And the supernatural is generally the last thing I would ever want, or I would ever try to contribute, you know, activity to, or something that I think I saw to, or if I'm helping someone who is going through something they're convinced is ghost activity, you know, I am the one who's like, okay, well, let's rule out environmental, let's rule out medical, which is the hardest to rule out. You know, let's do our best to rule out everything that's explainable, everything that falls in the realm of normal before we even step foot off of the abyss of the paranormal. So I don't use the supernatural in my everyday life to explain really much of anything. When there are, quite frankly, there are times that pop up in almost everyone's life where it could have just been, oh, my dead granny sent me that, or, you know, but I don't do that. I tend to try to be as, call myself a skeptical believer, because I want to debunk it as best as I can. A lot of times people don't want this to be the things that they experience to be paranormal. They don't, the fear of ghosts and, you know, things from the other
interesting.
Side scare them to a point where they don't want it to be that. And
I find it's the opposite, if I'm honest.
I would agree with Steve.
I think people desperately want to think that they're going to live forever, that they're going to surpass their life, that they're going to see their loved ones, that they see their dog, that they see, like, it, I mean, I don't anymore, but there's very few people I meet that don't want the supernatural, don't deeply, deeply want the supernatural to be true, be it in the form of God or reincarnation or just some astral plane or whatever it might be. Because really, it's our only hope for eternal existence. So it's interesting that, I mean, fair enough, like, you know, I appreciate there's going to be people that don't want to go for the supernatural answers, but yeah, at least in my experience, the vast majority of people want it, and that's actually something to be very wary of. If we emotionally want something, then that's a big red flag. We have to spend more time and attention to make sure that we don't, you know, have cognitive bias and dissonance towards positions that we want emotionally to be true.
And I'll be the first to admit I am one of those people. I don't believe in the supernatural or the paranormal because I don't believe there's sufficient evidence for it. But I want to believe, like, the idea that I could see certain family members and friends again. I love that. Like, that one day I could know everything because I could, be, you know, live on past this life. Like, that's an exciting thought to me. But just because I want that doesn't mean I should believe it. Which
to the contrary.
To my question. We got to wrap this call in just a moment, but Kate, if you don't know, and if we don't have a way to test this, then why do you believe?
Honestly, because it's more hopeful to believe than not to.
And I have a question from the audience. I keep forgetting to ask you this. One of the people wants to know if the door was still nailed shut after you heard that noise.
Yes.
Okay. Richard, I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, that was.
And then,
the door was still nailed shut. We could get through to the basement from inside the house as well.
And then Amit Matthew says, why are aliens or time-traveling pranksters never considered as potential explanations? My best guess is that they have underlying assumptions or an emotional connection to supernatural explanations.
I can tell you why.
Yeah.
They don't give us eternal life. They're an explanation that we can get to. It can easily explain, you know, why my cup went missing or why I forgot something at home. Like, we could plug it in with that instead of supernatural in the sense of, like, you know, ghosts and apparitions. But that explanation there doesn't give me what I actually want, which is to be able to live forever. So I'm going to favor the ones that also seem to carry something about an afterlife. That would be my answer to that. I think that's why they're never considered.
Kate, 1 minute or less, did you want to say anything? Say anything else?
Just because I, you know, I believe in this kind of thing, doesn't really necessarily mean that there is a life after this one. It doesn't mean that we're consciously aware of our friends and family that we meet on the other side. I don't believe in another side. I believe it's possible that there are several. So when I, that's why from my point of view, it doesn't matter to me whether or not the supernatural exists or doesn't exist. Should it, should I go somewhere after this place, I'm not going to be aware of it. So I think that's kind of where the difference comes in for those who want activity to be supernatural and those who don't.
Well, Kate, thank you.
If that makes any sense.
Thank you so much for taking the time to call in today. It was a good conversation.
Yeah, thank you kindly.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and I enjoyed very much talking to you guys.
Awesome. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
I'm telling you, Steve, I really do want ghosts to be real. Like, that is a really cool concept, and I would love their. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry if that's disappointing to hear.
No, you're not alone. Like, I get it. It's just, I mean, you got to watch out. If you want something to be true, you are going to find the evidence for it. Like, that tends to be the way that most people go.
I won't cave. I'm not budging. Like, right? Sorry, yeah. I can't say I'm not budging. I'll budge if evidence becomes available. But
yes,
it's going to take something really compelling for me to go, this is actually true.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get it. I totally get why people want it, especially here's one, intelligent aliens. I can totally see why people want that to be true. That would be very cool.
That'd be awesome.
And interestingly, like, I mean, you take the grand cosmos and everything, statistically, there's almost certainly very smart aliens that exist out there. Problem is that what's the chances of interaction? Very, very, very slim.
Well, yeah. I hope we get interactions with intelligent alien life someday.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Neil deGrasse Tyson did say something good on that, and that is that we don't try to really communicate with chimps that are basically
I was just so going to talk close. About that, because he said there's a, was it a 1% genetic difference between us and chimps? And if so, adult chimps can do what kids can do. And then he went into saying, imagine if aliens had that same 1% difference. And they're doing quantum physics at age 5.
Yeah. And it's like, would they really care to interact with us? No. It'd probably be not. Like the interactions that we have with basically every other species, complete extortion, annihilation, and then happy stickers being slapped on it. So it wouldn't be good. I don't want to meet aliens.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they're friendly. All right. So this, Otangelo, we don't have a lot of time, but I do want to get to your call. He wants to talk to you specifically, Steve, about a video about the genetic code and how it is not a result of evolution. Otangelo, you are on with Steve and Ethan. And by the way, have you unblocked me yet, Otangelo? Or are you still blocking me on Facebook?
I will unblock you, Ethan.
Oh, that's so sweet. Okay, all right. Go ahead. What do you got for us?
Yes. Hi, Stephen. It's a privilege to talk to you. I've seen your video, Genetic Code is God's Language Debunked. And the explanation basically which is being given is that it could be the result of evolution. And my objection to that is that the genetic code has to be fully developed and in operation when life actually starts and when DNA replication and translation starts, and that must be fully implemented in the cell. So the origin of the genetic code is not a problem of evolution, but you need to find an explanation which does not involve evolution. So I would like to know your view on that.
Yes. So pleasure to talk with you, by the way. I've seen you around and about on the internet. It's been you've given me hours of enjoyment listening to you. So yeah, thank you. And likewise. Now, the claim that was made in that video with me and John Perry from Stated Clearly, what we were dealing with is the idea that language is that DNA is a language that can only be explained by God, right? We wasn't dealing with abiogenesis. We wasn't dealing with the origin of life. We wasn't dealing with the origin of the genetic code, which is what you just referenced. So the video doesn't claim to debunk or state what you've just said. So I don't really know where you want to take that, but I didn't say in the video that we have an explanation for how DNA first emerged or even how life first emerged. We don't. We're genuinely, it's one of those mysteries. Just as before Paley, we really didn't know how complexity can emerge. Now it's been pushed back. The God of the Gaps has been pushed back to the point where we're not really sure how, I said we're not really sure. There's been some great strides forward, but we don't have a good answer or at least a sufficient answer for how life first emerged, and included in that is how DNA first emerged. So yeah, you where do you want to take that?
Yeah, this issue is specifically in regards of translation, and I guess you probably know what is involved. Do you know what translation is, what is happening during translation, what the genetic code actually does?
What, with how it's processed with the ribosome, or what specifically are you referring to this?
Yes,
in the terms of language and how it's coded?
The genetic code. Yeah, what is the function of the genetic code?
So it's part of a grander narrative, so you've got evolution by natural selection, which is, first of all, you've got replication. With evolution by natural selection, that's relatively random, but there's a random component that falls into that. Can you actually remind me, do you accept evolution by natural selection, or is it that you don't agree with?
Well, I would be very happy to have a long conversation with you in regards to what I think are the real mechanisms which explain organism complexity and architecture. And I think it's not natural selection, but it has to be pre-programmed code, not only on a genetic, but in special on epigenetic level. And I have categorized about 45 different epigenetic languages. So it is actually much, much more complex. The genes are just basically a library, which there has to be a gene regulatory network, which knows how to extract the information, the books in the genetic molecule, to then express it. So it is much, much more complex just than on a genetic level. But coming back, the genetic code...
I just want to really get clarification on that question. Do you accept evolution by natural selection? So John Lennox, for example, he accepts evolution by natural selection, but he happens to have a disagreement on DNA and, you know, what it is in terms of it being a language and how it's coded, etc. Are you there with John Lennox, or are you a creationist? Are you a proponent of intelligent design? Do you think evolution by natural selection isn't a good explanation? It doesn't explain the diversity of life. Basically, am I dealing with someone who's a creationist?
Yes, what,
Yes,
I am a creationist. I am also an intelligent design proponent. I know that change occurs, but it is not that natural selection which is actually responsible for the organismal architecture and complexity. There are other mechanisms in place which are much more variegated, they are more complex, and in special there is a lot of epigenetic information involved, and it is basically something which has to do with systems biology. So the entire cell is actually having several different mechanisms which operate in a joint venture together, and that requires a lot of pre-programmed information, which I think is not random, but it has to be pre-programmed.
Right. So why do you think it has to be pre-programmed? Like, what would be your argument for that?
Well, my argument for that, Steve, is that even if we are talking here about the origin of life, you need a minimal amount of information. And I have investigated this, and usually mycoplasma is referenced as the smallest self-replicating cell, but it is a symbiont. It depends on another host organism, so it cannot be the smallest example. And the smallest known free living cell, which actually synthesizes all the 20 amino acids, is Pelagibacter ubique. That is a good example, and it has about 1.3 million nucleotides. That is already a huge quantity of information, which is basically instructional assembly information, which instructs how that bacteria has to be assembled together and how it operates. Now, if you make a calculation, since there was no evolution to explain the origin of life, so you have basically just random chance or unguided random mechanisms, what the odds would be to have that first living cell, the odds are 1 to 10 to the 700,000 power. So this is an unimaginably huge number. Well, you can calculate it. I mean, just an amino acid change of about 100 amino acids, where each position, each amino acid you have to select amongst 20 different amino acids, you have odds in the order of 1 to 10 to the 130th power. That would be just Let's suppose you have just two amino acids. So the odds are 1 to 400 because in each position you can select between 20 different amino acids. So you multiply 20 multiplied by 2, it's 400. So if you have
is this you assuming complete randomness?
Yes, because there was no natural selection before life just, started.
The thing is that when we get to the beginning of life, abiogenesis, we have to, at the moment, if we're going to be, you know, scientifically respectful, we have to hold up our hands and say, we don't know the variables. And then when someone wants to go, okay, we don't know the variables, so let me take what we do know and then give you a number that, you know, seems astronomically unlikely, that's based on the worst possible scenario, which is just random chance, a complete roll of the dice. That doesn't seem like the correct way to approach it. Surely, when it comes to the origin of life, you know, the very beginning part here, our answer just has to be, we don't know the variables. We can't start making claims about how likely or unlikely something is. I guess you could, in terms of if you just say it's completely random, well, that would be a good argument to say that it's not random. There's something else going on there. But you can't just then fill that with God or something. I mean, I guess you could, but we've made this mistake before. I say before, but where you don't accept evolution by natural selection as a fantastic explanation for the complexity and the diversity of life that we see, then maybe you won't see this error as clearly as I do in this argument from ignorance, this God of the gaps.
Well, as I said before, Steve, first of all, yes, we can actually have a notion about the range of possibilities. As I said before, you have in each position of each amino acid 20 amino acids to choose from. Okay, so we can actually make a calculation of probability here. Secondly, as I said previously, there was no natural selection because you need DNA replication in order to have natural selection. And that wasn't there because first you need to actually instantiate DNA replication. And that is as well an abiogenesis problem. So what is the only alternative? You cannot even invoke physical necessity. Why? Because the sequence in the genome, it has to be freely choosable. You cannot have any physical restriction because otherwise you cannot have an information-bearing somatophoretic molecule. So the sequence in the DNA is freely choosable, and that means if you do not have intelligent input, then the only alternative is actually and effectively random chance. And that is one of the big problems of abiogenesis, because there was no natural selection and there was no selection mechanism to choose the right sequence of nucleotides to then have a functional amino acids change, which then in the end would become a functional protein.
How do you know there's no other explanations?
Well, we work with what we actually know. What can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. So if you say there can be a different mechanism, but you cannot mention it, then I dismiss it. I work with what we know. And basically, it is dichotomy. Either
there
was
intelligence you making the claim,
or it was not.
No, it's not. So when someone asks you, how is it that you're ruling out these things, the burden is on you to demonstrate why you've ruled them out. Let me flip this on its head, and I think this will help with you explaining how you think I'm missing something. This will help me, if you don't mind. We used to look, this is fair enough, not you, but most people used to look at the complexity of what we have. You know, these fingers, just the eye and all of this stuff. And William Paley and others, they would look at this complexity and they would say, here's two explanations. Intelligent design, God created this this way. Or random chance, as Fred Hoyle, you know, facetiously put it, and it's stuck. It's like a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and assembling a Boeing 747 from the materials they're in, right? So random chance and God. This has been like one of the most powerful arguments throughout all of history for God's existence. I'd argue it's the best argument that's ever been given. It's a fantastic argument. Watchmaker analogy, it really, really pulls on our intuitions. But now we have an explanation for the diversity that we see, natural selection. So we sit here and we go, right, we really made a mistake there. And the mistake we made is being so cocksure of ourselves, going, it has to only be God or natural select, it has to be God or it has to be random chance. Like, we got egg on our face. We've realized that was a completely stupid mistake to make. We shouldn't do it again. And yet it seems to me that that is precisely what you're doing with abiogenesis. You're saying, okay, we've got life emerging. You can represent it as, you know, the first states of DNA or however you want to show this state of abiogenesis. You're saying God did it, or complete random chance, a tornado sweeping through a junkyard. It's the same argument. You've just pushed it to the next gap in our knowledge. Don't you see that you're committing yourself to all of the issues that Paley did? Like, it's the same argument from ignorance.
Steve, let me quote you here from a science paper, The Scientific Origin of Life, and it says, we hypothesize that the origin of life, that is the origin of the first cell, cannot be explained by natural selection.
Okay? No, I agree with that. Hang on. Sorry. Listen, I'm not saying natural selection will explain abiogenesis. It won't. I agree with you. I'm not saying natural selection is going to explain abiogenesis just as it explained complexity and diversity of life. I'm not saying that. The analogy here is that we were super confident that either God did it or it was random chance. And there was a third explanation. In this instance, it was natural selection. In the case of abiogenesis, it won't be natural selection. As you rightfully point out, absolutely, natural selection comes after life is here. Absolutely. But the same issue here is that we didn't know.
We have still a dichotomy here. Either intelligence was involved, or it was not involved, and you have not a third explanation, which would be natural selection, right?
Correct. That's true. Okay, you can have a dichotomy of saying either God did it or God didn't. That's what you can have as a dichotomy. It's either black or white. But the phrasing and the way that this argument comes across isn't using that as the dichotomy. It's rather saying either God did it or random chance, and that's a false dichotomy. We've learned that from Paley, and we should apply that to abiogenesis. You're saying the emergence of life was either God did it or random chance. That isn't a dichotomy in the sense of saying either God did it or God didn't do it. You've opened yourself out to the potential of there being a third option that comes in, just as natural selection did for Paley. And the thing is that whenever we put ourselves in a position where we say God did it or it was random, we keep on getting embarrassed by the fact that we got it wrong. We got it wrong. We keep making this fallacious mistake. It's almost like God, if he exists, has designed us to be incredibly fallacious and keep making these mistakes. I guess, maybe a private paper.
Hang on, Otangelo, let him finish, please.
Which confirms what I'm actually saying.
Otangelo, let him finish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, okay, sorry.
The fact that you, rather than interacting with what I'm telling you, you would just bring out a new paper or whatnot, tells me that realistically, you and I should probably have a private conversation where we can take the time to actually go through this and get everything that you and I want on the table. So potentially that can be arranged if you'd be interested. Because
sure.
What it feels like I'm hitting you with these crucial points. I need you to give me a symmetry breaker. And rather than dealing with what I'm putting in front of you, you're going, okay, but what about this paper? And it's like, no, like we've got twice now to the major issue here. You are committing yourself to an argument from ignorance. You're saying either God did it or random chance. And I'm telling you, you're making the same mistake that William Paley made when it came to the diversity of life. He said either God did it or random chance. Now, natural selection turned up and it was the third option, showed us, you know, that we totally got that wrong, right? Natural selection won't be what comes up in terms of abiogenesis. But how do you know that there won't be a third option? Because that is what you're committing yourself to when you say that it is necessarily either God or random chance. Like, how do you answer that question?
Okay, 2 points. First of all, I'm backing up what I'm saying by quoting this paper, Origin of Life, the Prebiotic Route to DNA. The first polymeric molecules capable of storing information and reproducing themselves were randomly assembled from organic precursors that were available on the early Earth. So I keep saying that in my understanding, there are just two options you can exclude natural selection. One is intelligence and the other is random chance. And in regards of that, we don't know if there is eventually a third option. I am saying to you, the claim is yours. If you think there is a third option, bring it to the table, and then we will look it up. But if you say, well, there is maybe a third option, but we don't know what it is, then I am saying what can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. And if you don't have evidence that there is a third option, then I am simply going to dismiss it because you have nothing on the table.
What do you think to this? Okay, because I think that you've got the wrong end of who has the burden here. You are saying that either God did it or it's random chance. You are saying that. You're the one making the claim. I am remaining agnostic. I'm saying I don't know the answer. I don't have enough information to be able to make a judgment on abiogenesis. You are the one who's asserting that it is either God or random chance. Well, as you just said, that which is asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. What you're asserting right now, I'm asking you, how do you know there's not a third option? You have the burden of proof. You're the one that's making the statement that there's only two, random chance and God, not me, right? I'm not saying that. So how do you justify your burden? It's not my burden. How do you know there's no third option?
Well, okay, I'll give you here. Well, I will back up what I am saying, Steve, and I will quote here from Paul Davies. He says, how did stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software? Nobody knows. There is no known law of physics able to create information from nothing. And I think this is especially awesome. Cells have a codified description of themselves in digital form, stored in genes, and have the machinery to transform it into a physical reality of that description. We really know only of minds being able to do this, okay? To suggest that a physical process can create instructional assembly information, a recipe or a blueprint, is like suggesting that throwing ink on paper will create a blueprint. It is never going to happen. I think this
relates to the fact that you don't accept natural selection, because like John Perry has explained this at length in our longer conversation, for instance, the very mechanism that explains the complexity of what we have, right? The natural selection entirely explains how the language of DNA is just an instance of coevolution. It's just, if you imagine yourself as an ecosystem, and then you've got all of this natural selection processing inside of you, with them being the species, it's no different to how we interact with our ecology. So natural selection explains how you can have the evolution of language, the language of DNA, known as a system-based communication system. So I guess that's just relating back to the fact that you haven't got past Paley. You still think Paley is correct. You still think that natural selection isn't a solution to the diversity of life. So it would require a debate about evolution by natural selection before we could even really talk about abiogenesis. In that case, if you're not going to buy that you can have Igor.
So we only got about 3 minutes left. So Otangelo, if you could keep your response to about a minute long, that'd be great.
Sure. Okay, I'll quote here from Paul Davies, why Darwinian evolution does not explain the origin of life. That is a recent paper from September 2021.
I agree.
I think in all honesty, a lot of people even confuse it, the people who aren't familiar with the area, that, I presume Darwinian evolution sort of accounts for the origin of life. But of course, you don't get an evolutionary process until you've got a self-replicating molecule. Darwin gave us a theory of evolution about how life has evolved, but he didn't want to tangle with how you go from non-life to life. And for me, that's a much bigger step. So, Steve, you cannot, again, invoke natural selection when it is in regards to explaining the origin of life, in regard to explain the first minimal information that has to be stored in DNA, the origin of the genetic code, which translates information from messenger RNA to amino acids. That assignment.
Right. Excuse my abruptness. I have to interrupt. Okay.
That assignment. Okay. Go ahead.
The reason I need to interrupt is, let me ask you this question. What if I said in this conversation, or indeed anywhere, that indicates that I think natural selection could possibly be the answer to abiogenesis? What have I said that gives you that idea?
Well, I mean, that is my entire point, and I have kept during our entire conversation insisting on that. And you've brought up a natural selection despite this not being justified in a conversation about abiogenesis.
Why?
So we should leave
why did I bring
out
up
of the conversation and stick.
Why did I bring up natural selection?
Why did you actually bring it up if you are talking about the origin of life and the abiogenesis?
I wasn't talking about the origin of life. The reason I brought up natural selection is because it is the instance of the third, the breaker between the false dichotomy that William Paley brought up. I'm using it as an analogy. I'm saying that with William Paley, there was a third option. In that case, it was natural selection. He didn't see it. A lot of people didn't see it. Turns out
there is no third
option
now, because we don't have Darwinian evolution in the origin
of
life. Okay,
prove it. No. That's not the point. The point is that there was a third. When William Paley existed and he looked at the complexity of life, he said it's either God or random chance, right? That's what he said. And it seemed very intuitively powerful. It was a great argument. Again, I think it's the best argument that theism has ever had. Now, what he was putting himself to, he was making the claim that these are the only two options, random chance or God. That's what he was explaining as the only two options. The reason I brought up natural selection is just to say, look, we found a rebutting defeater. We found a situation where there was a third option. But even before we found a third option, even if we never discovered a third option, Paley was still fallacious in his argument. That's the point. It doesn't matter. It's natural selection was the third example here. But it doesn't matter if it was natural selection or something else that actually explained it. Paley didn't justify his claim that these are the only two to work with. And I think it's rather clear that that's what people like yourself are doing when it comes to the origin of life. You're insisting that there's only two options. And then when we ask you, can you tell me how you know that there's only two options? You're either bringing up natural selection, which is not what I agree with you. Natural selection isn't going to be the answer, but I want to know how you know there is no other answer other than random chance. And that's the difficulty. That's the thing you'd need to convince me of. But we went over this a couple of times, so I guess I'll give you the last word. Just thanks for your time.
30 seconds or less, Otangelo. And then we got to wrap.
Yes, as I said, sure. As I said previously, if you see an instructional blueprint to make a machine, and then you see that instructional blueprint going to a factory where factory workers can actually read that instructional information, based on that information can make a machine, and in the end, even factory, and you don't know where all this came from, then it is obvious that intelligence was involved from the beginning to the end. And that is precisely analogously to what we see in life and in the cell, where the information stored in genes directs the making of molecular machines, which are proteins and cell factories. So if we have one situation where we know the cause, which is we as humans making blueprints and factories and machines, and we don't know the origin of the other cause because it's not so obvious, but if they are analogous, then it is rational to conclude that the other had a similar cause. And I think that intelligence
gotta wrap,
is superior.
Otangelo.
Okay. I finished.
Did you want to respond to that, Steve, before we let him go?
It would take a couple of minutes, so I guess I'll leave it. Believe me, I want to, and I've enjoyed the conversation, but I'll leave it on that front for now.
Okay. Otangelo, thank you for your time and waiting on hold, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yes, I appreciate to have taken my call, Ethan, and I promise I will unblock you on Facebook.
All right, sounds good. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, and I look forward to have some private conversations on these topics with Steve. I will send him a message on Messenger on Facebook.
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Hopefully that last call didn't drain you too much. It sounds like you are up for the Discord after show.
Absolutely. Let's do this.
Sweet.
Absolutely.
So for those who don't know, after the show, we go into Discord. We do like a post-show talk where the mods and everyone comes on and we just have a chat. I want to thank my top-tier patrons. And I didn't have my sheet up. I should have had that ready. My bad. Okay. Cindy Plaza, Left, Right, Left, Kenneth Leonard, Sky, Jump and Shoot, Oz, Secular Rarity, Philip Leach, Caitlin Beyond, Toast, Richard Gilliver, Sunset Sarge, Amit Matthew, Ray Sylvester, Kyle Brewer. Thank you so much for your patronage. Steve, what do you got going on in your channel, or what do you have coming up?
Oh, I've got lots. The next year is going to be fun. I'm going to be mixing it up with some casual debunking like normal and more academic work. Starting to split the content in such a way. I've also got another game in the works that's just going to, going to be really, really fun. I think people are going to enjoy it. I'm pumped for next year. It's going to be positive.
Good. That's good to hear. I actually have something I want to talk to you about too after the show. Philip Leach, $5. Here's for Otangelo to understand that if he is arguing for an intelligent designer, he should use an intelligent argument. It doesn't change. Thank you, Philip, for your $5 super chat. Cool. Everyone, like, subscribe. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me. No, honestly, thank you very, very much for having me. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Sweet. All right. Everyone have a wonderful evening. We'll see you in the Discord after show.